I'm Melody Maraca.
And I'm Bill C.
Welcome back to the Into the Heart of U2 podcast, where two longtime fans discuss U2 music album by album and tour by tour, the fan experience, and the perception of U2 in cultural consciousness.
That's right. Melody and I, we came of age with U2. We saw it all happen in real time, and as we sit here in 2024, we still care about this band, but we're concerned about their legacy. So, as we take a trip back through the band's history, we're going to try and place it in proper context and ultimately get to the bottom of whether U2 is one of the greats of all time, or are the haters right after all?
All right. At the end of part one of this episode on No Line on the Horizon, we agreed the record is split into thirds. In part one, we covered the first third, made up of the first four songs of the record, which most closely represent the sessions in Fez, Morocco, created with Brian Eno and Daniel Lanois. And now we'll pick things up with the next three songs, which are the more pop-oriented numbers. Then we'll move on to the last third, which is basically a combination of the two, and we'll also get into the marketing of the record, the 360 tour, and where the band was moving forward. So, without further ado, let's pick things up with I'll Go Crazy If I Don't Go Crazy Tonight.
She's a rainbow and she loves the peaceful life. Knows I'll go crazy if I don't go crazy tonight. There's a part of me in the chaos that's quiet, and there's a part of you that wants me to riot. Everybody needs to cry or needs to spit. Every sweet tooth needs just a little hit. Every beauty needs to go out with an idiot. How can you stand?
You know, a lot of people point to this three-song stretch of I'll Go Crazy, Get On Your Boots, and Stand-Up Comedy as the band panicking and chasing a hit. And, you know, honestly, I generally agree with that. But for me, I'll Go Crazy is the least offensive of the three. There's parts of this song that have a, you know, kind of like a lilting quality that feels, you know, close to vintage U2 that I like. But does it belong on the record? Maybe the better question is, do any of these next three songs belong on the record? Probably not. What say you?
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree. The whole middle section of the album feels like an awkward pause, and worse, it's a little bit desperate in the attempt to put a song on the singles chart. Now, let me be clear, though. I don't have a problem with pop songs, and I don't think these songs are terrible, but they are very far from the band's finest.
No, nothing wrong with songs on the charts, but U2 at its best is when they get a hit out of pure happenstance, you know, not something that's contrived. And this section of the record feels a little calculated, at least compared to the Fez material. So for me, it just kind of throws things off its axis. Now, ironically, as we'd mentioned in part one, this song actually germinated from an Eno idea called Diorama back in Fez, but down the home stretch, as the band starts, you know, fretting over commercial prospects of the record, they take Diorama to Will I Am and transform it into the more, you know, upbeat and poppier incarnation that appears on the record.
Mm-hmm. Now, according to Jimmy Iovine, will.i.am's work on this song ends up inspiring him in the writing of the Black Eyed Peas' monster hit, I've Got a Feeling.
Which Bono's probably gnashing his teeth over.
Maybe so.
Anyway, interesting. Okay, now a couple of things really bug me about this song, starting with the title. If I Don't Go Crazy, I'll Go Crazy Tonight. I mean, this feels like some sort of new age aphorism, you know?
You know, I think you're giving the title just a little bit of love there, actually. I just think it's kind of silly.
Okay. I mean, that's hard to argue. I mean, honestly.
Now, Bono said that this song is meant to be No Line on the Horizon's version of A Beautiful Day. But I don't think the song has Beautiful Day's tunefulness or depth. It is catchy, but it feels uninspired. And if I had to classify it, I guess I'd call it harmless. And I really think that's its biggest problem.
Yeah, and I got to be honest, I don't love how Bono sings the lines in the verses in that falsetto. I mean, that really feels like an entirely unnecessary affectation that doesn't serve the song. I also don't think much of the lyrics in the verses, honestly. The chorus is okay. I do love the bridge after the baby, baby, baby. I know I'm not alone. That I don't like. But after that, I do really like the musical interlude of very, you know, like edge-like riffing. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, that part. That part, you know, that last bit of the bridge that goes, you see, for me, I've been shouting, the shout in the darkness that squeeze the sparks of life. Now, that I like. That feels like a moment of sunshine peeking through the clouds. You know, kind of vintage U2. So why don't we listen to that?
Really like the music overall for this one.
But not even that part?
No, I really, I don't. I just, okay, I really right. just, I kind of just don't yeah. really groove on this song. But before I get accused of working for Pitchfork.
And we have.
And I have, yeah. which I'm a U2 fan, man. Come on. But you can dislike some of the songs. I will say for this one, I like Adam's bass part. And, and I think some of the lyrics are clever. For example, I like the line, you know, the right to appear ridiculous is something I hold dear.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people quote that line. I mean, it's okay, but, you know, for me, it feels a little clunky. I mean, all those verses feel like kind of squeezing too much into a small space. And by the way, did you know this song actually got a Grammy nomination as Best Rock Song? I actually, that I didn't retain that information for whatever reason. Take that for what it is. But I mean, my point, like when I saw that or when I was reminded of it, I was like, if you want to know why the haters accuse you two of getting special treatment by being part of the establishment, I mean, I think that's one of the prime reasons right there.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of the song as a single, I should mention that this was the third and final single from the album. It was released in digital formats in August of 2009 and physically in September of that year. It didn't chart particularly well in most countries, but it did get some love from Scotland. It went to number one there.
All right, shall we move on?
Let's. Why don't we listen to you, Get On Your Boots?
Seen a moon like this, can you see it too? Night is falling everywhere, rockets hit the fun fair. Satan loves a bomb scare, but he won't scare you. Hey, sexy boots. Get on your boots, yeah.
Larry just loved this song, didn't he? Melody, why don't you read Larry's rather remarkable quote at the time Song of Innocence came out? And I just want to sit back, have a libation, and listen to it roll off your tongue. Go ahead.
I guess if you insist, but I will not try for the Irish accent.
Oh, really? Oh, come on.
Nah. Larry said, quote, Boots was an absolutely catastrophic choice for a single. It was madness, but the decision was made, and that was the beginning of the end. We never recovered from it, unquote.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot. all right. So let's talk about the choice of this as the first single. Bono said, quote, it was never an obvious first single because it's not a straight ahead rock or straight ahead anything. But it is sly and charming and sexy and playful and serious. It's an earnest love song. That's what's beautiful about it. But then Bono tends to forget he's not judge and jury. So the question is, did making this the first single doom the record?
Well, it sure didn't help the cause. Here's the thing. The song doesn't make sense on the album, and it isn't representative of the work as a whole.
Agreed.
then there's the problem that the song itself, it has a bit of an identity crisis with so many ideas crammed in. Not quite as blunt as Larry's words, but Adam said of the song, quote, "I think probably what happened was it's a common U2 problem. I think we probably worked on it and worked on it and worked on it. And instead of executing one idea well, I think we probably had five ideas in the song and it just confused people. They weren't sure what they were hearing," unquote. Now, I applaud the idea of exuberant creativity, but this song is a bit messy and ends up feeling forced.
The song is routinely called the worst U2 single, and some even say the worst U2 song ever. You know, I don't hate the song, and I've got my own opinion on what the worst U2 single is, but we're not there yet. But yeah, I agree. This song really has no business being on the record. In any respect, Bono tells us the lyrics are an attempt to use some irony of a family vacation filled with love and fun by contrasting that with the Iraq war and warplanes flying overhead. But the odd structure, the retro vibe, and strange chord changes going into the chorus just didn't connect and really sent the wrong message about what this record was about.
Yeah, but I will say I do like the contrasts in the lyrics, in the images of the fighter jets flying over a fun fair on the way to war. I mean, that's cool. But yeah, it just doesn't sound cohesive.
Yeah, I really agree. But let's go into the background here.
Yeah.
Boots began as a garage band demo by The Edge that he brought in pretty fully formed. But as the band is wont to do, they deconstructed it. And even cut the central riff, leaving it sounding like what Steve Lillywhite describes as a Beck B-side that was in danger of being dropped from the record altogether. Oh, what might have been, right? Mm-hmm. But seriously, I watched It Might Get Loud recently, and I'd forgotten there's a scene in there where Edge is working on this song, I assume before he turned it over to U2. And I was kind of fascinated because it sounds like he's playing it entirely in 2/4 time. And it sounds like, you know, really heavy. But anyway, I think doing it in 4/4 actually steamrolled it. And so I want to take a listen to, you know, that clip from the movie. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if you two could have pulled it off, but it almost feels like a metal dirge, which at least doesn't make it sound like a cheap imitation of Vertigo, which I think most people kind of thought of it as.
Yeah, that's true.
So just for fun, let's listen to that clip from It Might Get Loud.
I drive everyone crazy. I drive myself totally crazy trying to get the sound that I can hear in my head to come out of the speakers.
Now, before we move on, one of the fun things about doing this podcast is discovering stuff about the band that I've never heard or seen before. Now, a lot of folks say that Boots is very reminiscent of Elvis Costello's Pump It Up. And to be honest, I really never paid much attention to that until I heard Bono and Edge playing a mashup of Boots with Pump It Up on Elvis Costello's British-Canadian TV show, which was called Spectacle, Elvis Costello With. Have you ever heard this?
I love that show, but I actually never saw that. I mean, I know the verses are similar, but no, I never saw that clip.
Well, so in this episode, Bono and Edge appeared, and it was filmed in September of 2009 during the 360 tour. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things that once you hear it, it really can't be unheard. And I'm actually shocked that Bono and Edge did it, but we should take a listen to this just for fun.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Now, we already talked about Boots's poor commercial performance in part one of this episode, especially in the States, but let me give the particulars. When the song was released in January of 2009, it went into the U.S. singles charts at number 40. And then the next week, it fell to number 96. And then after that, it disappeared entirely. It fared far better in the U.K., going to number 12. And it did go to number one in Ireland and Scotland. And like we said, the Scots appeared to really have grooved on the singles from this album. It was a top 10 hit in Canada, France, Hungary, Italy, Japan, the Netherlands, and Sweden. Okay, so where are we going now?
Well, we've got stand-up comedy. Let's give it a listen.
I gotta stand up and take a step. You and I have been asleep for hours. I gotta stand up, the wire is stretched.
Stand-up comedy, it's another song that went through multiple iterations. The original idea for the song was developed during the Fez Morocco sessions when it had a Middle Eastern beat and was accompanied by mandolins.
That's right. With Bono singing over it, we don't know what the future's going to bring. Now, personally, I would love to hear that version.
Me too.
But maybe one day. In any case, Danny Lanois said the track had been recreated so many times that six different songs had been written as a result. Brian Eno felt that the band had worked it into the ground. Sounds so unlike you two.
Now, one of those iterations was a song called For Your Love. But the band scrapped that version since they felt the guitar sounded too much like the Kinks' You Really Got Me. And the lyrics sounded too much like the Yardbirds song with the same title, For Your Love.
Lanois went on to say, at one point it had turned into another song altogether. A great song, he said. But in the end, it felt crafted, more craft than soul. And we like to make soul music, end quote. Finally, The Edge landed on the heavy riff you hear on the final version that came about after his involvement in the aforementioned It Might Get Loud documentary. Certainly, you can hear some Zeppelin influence in that riff. But frankly, I mean, for me, only on a very surface level, kind of Flintstonian way.
Did you just say Flintstonian?
I was actually very proud of myself for that. I mean, you know, Flintstonian.
I like that.
No, I mean, like, you know, like a caveman stomping along with only rudimentary understanding of Led Zeppelin. Tung, tung, tung. You know, like one of those things.
Yeah.
But, you know, I will say I do like Edge's solo, kind of molten lava kind of solo there. That feels kind of fresh if you want to listen to that.
Yeah, let's do it. Okay, so you two kept revisiting this song right up until December of 2008, the deadline for delivering the record, a full 16 months after its inception in Fez. Now, the song's lyrics were inspired by the 2008 Stand Up and Take Action campaign, which was the name of an annual global mobilization coordinated by the United Nations Millennial Campaign and the Global Call to Action Against Poverty.
Yes. And there's also several other lines that are, I would say, Bono's attempt at self-deprecating humor. That's in those lines, stand up to rock stars, Napoleon in high heels, Josephine, be careful of small men with big ideas. Another line a lot of the reviews quoted was, stop helping God across the road like a little old lady. I mean, I know that got a lot of play, but I have to say, I'm not enamored with any of these lyrics. In fact, I think these are the least impressive lyrics on the record, and I'm not a big fan of this kind of self-referential lyric writing. I mean, it comes off like campaigning for better branding for Bono. I'm sorry. I mean, and that's no small part why this is my least favorite song on the entire record. Another one that I don't think belongs here.
I like the theme of the lyrics, you know, standing up against complacency and for hope, faith, love. But yeah, I agree with you. The lyrics are a little too sloganeering for my taste. And overall, I don't hate the song either. It just doesn't do much for me. I certainly agree it doesn't fit here. Maybe it would have worked much better on How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, all I can say is, look, we made it through this awkward three-song stretch of shameless hit chasing, so good on us for that. Yeah. And so unless you have anything else, I'm ready to move on.
Yeah, why don't we go ahead and take a listen to Fez Being Born?
Yes, let's.
So this song is comprised of two conjoined songs, Fez and Being Born. Mm-hmm. Now, the Fez portion of the song, which lasts about a minute, is the clearest link to the band's initial experimental intentions for the record. I really groove on its ambient, trance-like feel, punctuated by the reprise of Let Me In the Sound from Boots. Very, very cool. Mm-hmm. This part of the song was originally created by Edge when the band was working with Rick Rubin and Green Day during the recording of The Saints Are Coming back in 2006. That musical piece was shelved and then later rediscovered by Daniel Lanois, who added in a beat by Brian Eno. Lanois played that part for the band, and Bono commented that it sounded like, quote, almost something coming to life, like a flower opening or coming into the world, unquote. It was Lanois who also thought that Fez would pair well with the more muscular song Being Born, which he edited to be in the same key as Fez.
Yeah. Lanois then sutured the two pieces together using the sound it makes when you toggle through different settings on, you know, some kind of outboard gear in the studio, like a reverb unit or something. Mm-hmm. And it was then provisionally titled Chromium Chords and then renamed Tripoli before the band settled on, of course, Fez Being Born. This song here actually does connect to the storyline of Linear, what little storyline there is, of the disillusioned Parisian cop hopping on his motorcycle and heading south through France and Spain to North Africa with the lines on the autoroute, burning rubber, burning chrome, Bay of Cadiz, which is in Spain, just a few miles from Morocco, and ferry home, Atlantic Sea, cut glass, African sun at last, end quote. Then we get the lights flashing like memories, and then it transforms into the perspective of a baby, quote, being born, a bleeding start, engines roar, blood-curling wall, head first, then foot, then heart set sail, end quote. I really like all that, so if you don't mind, let's give it a listen.
The Being Born portion, it might be a tad too long, but I do like the song very much. I especially like the sci-fi-ish synthesizer bit that separates the second chorus from the second verse and is picked up again towards the end of the song. also enjoy Bono's contribution, both sonically and lyrically. I think it's very evocative. I don't happen to think he actually owns this song, though.
No, I actually think Bono here is controlled and sits himself nicely into the music instead of, you know, like overwhelming it as he does a few times on the record. I know we disagree on this, but that's one of my, you know, complaints. But here, I think he really kind of just like settles in really nicely. This song feels like a band piece and lets everyone shine. And, you know, I went on last episode about how I wish this would have opened the record, you know, what with the lyrics being about birth. And you can also argue it's a metaphor for a musical birth for the band and the album's creation. At least that's what was the impetus. But, you know, I've been thinking, you know, since we recorded part one, Melody, and I actually wish Soon had been the first track and then Into Fez Being Born. Now, that would have been a great 1-2 entry point, announcing this was something truly different. I mean, but hey, it's not the first time the band didn't check with me about such things.
Now, as I discussed in part one of the episode, I love the first four tracks on the album. But, Bill, I will give you Soon, Into Fez Being Born. That sounds like a great sequence.
Yeah, well, now see, looky there. We agree on something. after the title track discussion, I think that's noteworthy. Anyway, I really love the song. You love it. A standout track. Are you ready to move on?
Yeah, let's do that. Let's go ahead and take a listen to White as Snow.
Yeah.
Well, I came from there where no hills at all. The land was flat, the highway straight and wide. My brother and I would drive for hours like we'd years instead of days. Our faces as pale as the dirty snow.
All right, so during part one of this episode, we mentioned that one of Bono's initial ideas for the album was to write hymns for the future. And wanting to find some inspiration for the band, Daniel Lanois asked fellow Canadian musician and friend, Laurie Anna Reid, to come up with some hymns that might inspire. And she suggested O Come, O Come, Emmanuel. And I'll admit that I've had some fun singing O Come, O Come, Emmanuel along with this song. But as you know, Bill, I'm kind of a dork in that way.
And I'm so pleased you're letting our audience know your dorkiness, as I know you. But anyway, yes, this is, of course, not the first time the band built something new from something old. The Edge, of course, had previously written Van Diemen's Land, based on the Irish classic The River is Wide.
True. And, you know, I do love the music here. The beginning piano, it's heartbreaking. The picking guitar adds an interesting Celtic flavor, particularly in the bridge with the lines and the water. It was icy as it washed over me. There's such a sadness to the music that clues you into the song, even without knowing the backstory of the lyrics, which Bono has said are about the thoughts of a soldier in Afghanistan who is dying from a roadside bombing. And the song lasts the length of time it takes him to die.
Yes, this is Bono at his most lyrically thought-provoking, adding, I'd say, a gorgeous restrained vocal that embodies the character. I mean, he's crafted it beautifully. I also love the French horn and the use of dynamics in the song, courtesy of Eno Lenoir's production. I love that part where Bono climbs vocally to you know that part?
I do.
That's a super cool part, and I think we should listen to it.
Thank you.
written for Jim Sheridan's 2009 film Brothers, along with another song, Winter, which we discussed in part one, that didn't make the record. The song, in part, focuses on the strained relationship between the brothers central to that film, played by Tobey Maguire and Jake Gyllenhaal. But in my opinion, thematically, the song owes more to its initial inspiration, the William Golding novel, Pincher Martin, which is about a British soldier stranded alone on a small island in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean after his ship was torpedoed. Both the book and the song have at the core an existential and spiritual examination of life. And, you know, I'll remind everyone that this isn't the first time Bono has turned to William Golding for inspiration. Golding's book, Lord of the Flies, was an inspiration for several songs on the Boy album. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Bono gives a great vocal performance, as you mentioned, to capture that melancholy character study. I particularly like the second verse, which is a subtle and thought-provoking meditation on a crisis of faith. Why don't we go ahead and take a listen to that?
Once I knew there was a love divine, then came a time I thought it knew me not. Who can forgive forgiveness where forgiveness is not?
So overall, I think it's pensive and restrained and beautiful and really a highlight on the album.
Yeah, definitely agree. This song feels fresh, at least for you too. My only quibble, I would have had the song come earlier like it does in the linear film. Here it feels a little too much like an afterthought stuck at the end. I like it that much, you know?
Mm.
Anyway, so what do we have up next?
We've got Breathe.
Said the Edge brought the music to Breathe pretty much totally intact. Eno said the version they worked on was one of his favorites of all time, but after he and Lenoir mixed the song over 80 times, the band decided to just re-record it down the home stretch with Steve Lillywhite, and they let him mix it. After the record came out, Eno cried out, "What happened to the version we did?" Guessing that's not the only time he said that.
Probably not.
Right.
Now, like stand-up comedy, Edge's guitar work here was influenced through his involvement in It Might Get Loud. I think you can hear some Jimmy Page and Jack White DNA in Breathe. But I think the song transcends a simple homage. It feels like U2 had digested the idea of blues rock and turned it into something very much their own. Now, I wasn't immediately taken with Breathe, but I've since come to love the song. I think it's a great rock and roll song with a cool driving feel. It's a great delivery from the whole band, and I love Bono's punctuated performance in the verses. Bono said of that delivery, quote, "It's a way to use words in a percussive way, but not have it be hip hop. It's somewhere between, you know, subterranean homesick blues, and I did a kind of character a bit like that at the end of Bold the Blue Sky. And I just wanted to go to a new place as a lyricist. And I thought making these short jabbing things made really great sense over these chords. Edge came up with a chord sequence there, and I liked the bracing tone. I was thinking about it in a very physical way. I was improvising it. The lines were coming out like that," unquote.
And I gotta say, I don't love that spitfire vocal delivery on the verses. I like the driving nature of the music, but at least on the verses, Bono's delivery is, you know, for me, just a little off-putting. It's just not a pleasurable listening experience. For me.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I really like these lyrics as they appear on the album, but there were actually two versions of lyrics, one about Nelson Mandela and the other Bono described as, quote, more surreal and personal, unquote, the latter of which, of course, were used.
Yes, Bono said American novelist Cormac McCarthy influenced the song's torrent of impressionist verse, and as a result, ultimately, they settled on the more surreal lyrical approach.
Now, we do get to hear a version of the song with the Mandela lyrics, which came out as a B-side for the Record Store Day vinyl release of the song Ordinary Love in 2013. Ordinary Love, of course, being recorded for inclusion on the Nelson Mandela film biography, Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom. I think the alternate version of Breathe is really interesting. So why don't we go ahead and take a quick listen to that version of the song?
Troublemaker, guided by the drums of my creator, toward a rhythm and rhyme, a melody line of a song called freedom, which once heard will never leave your head. We are people born of sound, the songs are in our eyes, gonna wear them like a crown. Whoa.
So the Mandela lyrics are set on July 18th, which is Nelson Mandela's birthday and commemorated as Mandela Day, whereas the more personal lyrics used on the album take place on June 16th, a nod to Bloom's Day, the day that James Joyce's novel Ulysses is set, which, among a great, great many other things, is an invocation of Dublin. As I mentioned, I think the lyrics are great. I love the immediacy of being dropped into the strange scene in the first verse. And for me, those great lines, coming from a long line of traveling salespeople on my mother's side, I wasn't going to buy just anyone's cockatoo.
And I got to stop you. I find that a very odd moment. He couldn't have come up with anything better for the traveling salesman to be selling than a cockatoo. That really jumps out and feels odd to me, especially the way he seems winded trying to spit all that out in one breath.
You know, it's funny. It's exactly those reasons why I groove on this lyric and the delivery. It's funny. It's interesting. It sounds like we're listening to two different records. But I love the randomness and the edge of the verse's images. But I also really love the earnestness and struggle for survival in the choruses. My favorite is almost the pragmatic redemption of the last lines. I found grace inside a sound. I found grace. That's all I found. And I can breathe, breathe now.
Now, listen, I do love the choruses. That's a whole different animal. I love the words, I love the music, and I love the theme of proclaiming you need to stand your ground no matter the resistance. I mean, this bravery allows one's freedom to breathe. And it's also interesting to note that the narrator finds, as you noted, redemption that eludes so many of the album's other characters. I love the lines, every day I die again and again, I'm reborn, walk out into the street. I mean, I love all that. So let's listen to that.
Every day I die again and again, I'm reborn.
Listen, for me, it's almost a tale of two songs. The verses, which for me don't land, and the choruses, which are great. So that's just me.
That is just you.
It is just me. Anyway, so I think we've reached the last track. What is it?
Well, it's Cedars of Lebanon.
All right, let's listen.
Yesterday I spent asleep. Woke up in my clothes in a dirty heap.
Spend the night trying to make a deadline. Squeezing complicated lives into a simple headline. I have your face in an old Polaroid.
Cedars of Lebanon is built on a sample from Against the Sky, a song on the 1984 Brian Eno and Harold Budd album, The Pearl. I love the atmospheric music set against a martial drum beat from Larry. It feels moody and sad around the edges, which is a perfect match for Bono's world-weary vocal delivery and lyrics that are beautifully crafted.
Yeah, the music imbues a kind of ghostly minimalism with all sorts of cool backing vocals, ambient noises, a whine of an ebo, and I agree, Larry's drumming is crucial. It really carries it down the tracks. It's beautifully mixed and produced, like White as Snow. This feels like fresh ground for you too.
I agree. Now, lyrically, it's written in sketch format from the point of view of a war correspondent on assignment. It's really the best example of Bono's use of character on the album, as well as the best example of the lyrical viewpoint Bono had meant to capture on the album, which was feeling the world at large, not directly, but as if it was through a window, quote unquote, scratching at the window pane.
Yeah, I think this is probably Bono's best ever character study, and not just lyrically, but it succeeds in transforming into character in his performance as well. I mean, it's a rare example where his Bono-ness does not peek through and overtake the song. Here, a war correspondent who is, quote, squeezing complicated lives into a single headline, end quote, and who, quote, observes this shitty world, end quote, where the aroma of a rose, quote, lingers, and then it just goes, end quote. Also, I believe it's Bono's first sing-speak song since Walk to the Water. Maybe Bono was able to sink into the grooves of this character so well because he's always said, if not for you too, he could have seen himself becoming an overseas correspondent, something we touched on when we were talking about his writing on Bullet the Blue Sky on the Joshua Tree episode.
Yeah, and you know, another thing that impresses me about these lyrics is how much ground they cover using very sparse language. We get the whole essence of the main character really in the first four lines and understand his past and what drives his present all within the first verse. And while the central story of the atrocities of war remain integral, the lyrics can also be looked at in a more universal way. It's sort of a meditation on memory, a search for meaning, an exploration on suffering and human complexity. I mean, there are so many lines that I think are great, but the standout lines for me are those ending lines, which I'll read. I'm going to read.
Please.
Choose your enemies carefully because they will define you. Make them interesting because in some ways they will mind you. They're not there in the beginning, but when your story ends, going to last with you longer than your friends. Bono said of these lines, they were, quote, an insight into our band. It explains pretty much everything. You two chose more interesting targets than other bands. Your own hypocrisies, your addictions, but not to the obvious, your ego. I think we made our enemies very interesting. And although No Line on the Horizon has such a strange arch as a whole, I do think this song is a fitting ending. And for me, it's the best ending of a U2 album since The Wanderer on Zooropa.
Well, it's certainly the most ominous last song on any U2 record. Not exactly the unifying resolution of the hymn-like 40 or Mothers of the Disappeared or Yahweh. So why don't we listen to that closing? Because I think you're right. It's pretty special.
Choose your enemies carefully, cause they will define you. Make them interesting, cause in some ways they will mind you. They're not there in the beginning, but when your story ends, gonna last with you longer than your friends.
Now, before we move on, I'll just say, This kind of opaque meditation on the Iraq War is probably the most you can expect from Bono at that point. This is a topic he avoided while he worked with George W. Bush and Tony Blair on aid to Africa. That said, Bono would go on to remark, quote, "I think of all the energy that went into that and the bravery of the men and women who served, and I think of what those resources could have achieved. If only the lives of the poorest of the poor were as valuable as the idea of bringing democracy to the desert," end quote. Somewhere, Larry is ruefully shaking his head. All right, since there's no bonus track like on the last couple records, Melody, why don't you go first and tell us your takeaway of No Line on the Horizon?
Okay, as we discussed during part one, something that didn't help this record's cause was the early days marketing and press the band did during the 4.5 year wait between Atomic Bomb and No Line on the Horizon. First, it was Rick Rubin collaborating, then talk of North African experimentation with Brian Eno and Daniel Lanois, and then Steve Lillywhite popped into the picture. While understandable that the band wanted to capture some attention during the long wait between albums, chatting up the fans in this way gave some pretty big impressions about what was coming. And then we got Get On Your Boots, which no one was expecting, and I don't mean that in a good way. Now, I mean, U2 sold the hell out of that song during the album's marketing campaign, but it was a weak single and also one of the weakest tracks on the album. Obviously, I am not a casual U2 fan, so my relative non-excitement about Boots didn't kill off my interest in the album. And what I heard and what we've been talking about is an album in three parts, or three acts, as it were. Now, I really think the first and third acts are outstanding. Certainly not the unforgettable fire set in Morocco that a lot of us were initially hoping for, but really strong songs. And in fact, as I've said, the first four songs on this album, the title track, Magnificent, Moment of Surrender, and Unknown Caller, as a piece, is actually one of my favorite things U2 has ever done. And Moment of Surrender on its own is one of U2's most underrated masterpieces, in my opinion. And the third act of the record also has some great songs, really interesting music and lyrics. My personal favorite is the reflective White as Snow. And I also really love the sort of messy rock and roll of Breathe. But I think all four of those final songs are solid. Interestingly, I think No Line on the Horizon, along with Pop, are the U2 albums that I listen to the most nowadays. Maybe they're, I don't know, we can look at them as the controversial stepchildren of the U2 canon. But while I listen to Pop all the way through, warts and all, I do tend to skip the middle section of No Line. If I don't go crazy, Boots, stand-up comedy. For me, interrupt the album's flow. And as a listener with the power of hitting skip, I prefer the album without them. My take is that they are just manifestation of the band's and certainly Bono's obsession with this idea of staying relevant, which translates to having hits. And jamming these more accessible songs into a, if not experimental, then certainly more serious and reflective album, worked to derail it as a cohesive whole. You know, and why the band and really, I think Bono in particular is so fixated on this type of relevance during the latter half of the band's career, maybe between him and his therapist. But certainly as it relates to this album, the decision to jam songs so out of place into this work is baffling and frankly a little upsetting.
Bono has long said U2 basically breaks up after every tour and then reforms to make the next record. And I think that's true, at least since the making of the War record. And for the vast majority of their history, this has been a wildly successful formula. And I believe it's one of the pillars to U2's lasting legacy. However, for this record, I don't think the version of U2 that emerged here ever found its footing. There was never a unifying vision or a galvanizing track that carved a pathway forward and gave the overall project an identity. By way of example, that song was One on Octoon Baby, When All Seemed to Be Lost. Now, in the lead up to this record, Bono made all sorts of promises, which we've covered, about the band getting back to its experimental side. But then after the album failed to live up to expectations, he said, it was too challenging for us. Bono said, quote, look, sometimes our audience isn't as groovy as we'd like. Get On Your Boots is a sort of crossover, half club, half indie rock record. Our audience wants vertigo. And when we did this the last time with Discotheque, they didn't like it either. I mean, I have to really say, what the hell, Bono? I mean, Boots, it just wasn't very good. I mean, you know, just own it. And the suggestion the album was too challenging is absurd. It wasn't challenging enough. Look, the freshest and most innovative tracks here are the more subdued and meditative. Moment of Surrender, Fez Being Born, White as Snow, Cedars of Lebanon, while the weakest and most rote are the rock and roll songs. For me, If I Don't Go Crazy, Boots, Stand-Up Comedy, I Know You Like Breathe, but Breathe to me kind of detracts from those more meditative numbers that I mentioned that I feel are really fresh. Clearly, the band wasn't comfortable with an entirely experimental record, which is what led them to go off and write those three pop songs that felt desperate. And I really believe if those songs were not on the record, as you have also said, and they at least included Soon and Winter and just announced, hey, this is what it is, take it or leave it, the record would have been seen in an entirely different light. And the fact is, U2 of the 90s would have taken all these songs as far as it could be stretched. Unfortunately, this version of U2 couldn't stomach it. And that is a real shame. No Line on the Horizon will always be something that should have been so much more. All right, let's talk about the marketing and promo, shall we, Melody?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. The first appearance U2 makes after turning the record in is at U.S. President Barack Obama's inauguration celebration on January 18th, 2009, performing City of Blinding Lights and Pride in the Name of Love in front of the Lincoln Memorial, right where Martin Luther King made his I Have a Dream speech in 1963. So far, so good. But Melody, you've heard me say many times, just because you can do something doesn't always mean you should. And for the promotional campaign of No Line on the Horizon, the band really exerted its muscle and influence to get access and opportunity no artists could.
Right. Well, let's take it from February of that year. They opened the Grammy Awards, the Brit Awards, and Germany's Echo Awards with Get On Your Boots, without the song or album being nominated. And then they also appeared on French television and radio. In the States, in March, the band performed at Fordham University, which was shown live on Good Morning America. The band also broadcast U2 Three Nights Live, a series of radio interviews and performances across North America, and was also streamed live on U2.com. Then they also appeared for an unprecedented five consecutive nights on The Late Show with David Letterman. And during the run of Letterman's shows, New York's mayor, Michael Bloomberg, added a street sign reading U2 Way at 53rd Street in Manhattan.
And that's not all. U2 also received blanket coverage across BBC, culminating with a concert on the roof of the Broadcasting House. Tory MP Nigel Evans stated that it was, quote, the sort of publicity money can't buy, end quote, adding, quote, why should license fee payers shoulder the cost of U2's publicity, end quote. Experts calculated the cost at £1 million. The BBC, which critics branded the Big Bono Corporation, later acknowledged that coverage of the U2 album launch breached guidelines, and that use of the on-screen logo U2 equals BBC gave an inappropriate impression of endorsement. What made them think that? All right, anyway.
Yeah.
Now, moving on.
Moving on, yeah. Now, something else that the band, or more specifically Bono, was talking about during the promotion of No Line on the Horizon was a companion album that was planned to be released within a year of No Line.
That's right. The now mythical and still yet to surface Songs of Ascent. This was to be a sister release to No Lawn in the Horizon, a Zaropa to its Octune Baby, a ghost album of hymns and Sufi singing that No Lawn in the Horizon wasn't. Bono even said Every Breaking Wave would be its first single, adding, quote, "We're making a kind of heartbreaker, a meditative, reflective piece of work, but not indulgent." Sorry.
Never.
Sorry. "It will all have a clear mood, kind of like Kind of Blue or A Love Supreme would be a point of reference," end quote.
Now, the title, Songs of Ascent, is taken from a group of psalms, Psalm 120 through 134, that are also referred to as pilgrim songs. Each of those psalms in this group begins with the title, A Song of Ascents. And eventually, those psalms were sung by pilgrims ascending the hills to Jerusalem for Jewish festivals. Anyway, the album has been discussed and shelved, I don't even know how many times over the years. Right. And I mean, it seems clear that there have been multiple versions of it. Maybe it'll be the band's final release. I mean, who knows?
Maybe. I mean, I personally don't think Songs of Ascent will ever materialize, at least while the band is still making records. Added to the list of fascinating albums that never were, like The Beach Boys' Smile, The Who's Lifehouse, Marvin Gaye's Love Man. I mean, who knows? All right. So anyway, let's talk about the 360 tour, shall we?
Let's do it.
So the story goes, Bono is in a restaurant sometime during the Vertigo tour, and he stands four forks up and leans them toward each other, creating an early prototype for what becomes the stage design for the 360 tour. Kind of sounds like something from Spinal Tap.
Yes, it does.
I'm sorry, I couldn't resist. Anyway, something that comes to be known as the Claw. Longtime tour designer Willie Williams then brings this spaceship on four legs steel structure to life, modeling it after the landmark theme building at Los Angeles International Airport. And it truly was a sight to behold. The Claw becomes a 164-foot-tall structure supporting 250 speakers and a cylindrical LED video screen enabling the band to play in the round on a circular stage, allowing the audience to surround them on all sides, hence the 360 tour.
Yeah, and between the 360 audience configuration and moving the stage closer to the center of the stadium venues, increased audience capacity by 15% to 20%, depending on location. And this was really fortuitous for the band because that stage design was not cheap. And to accommodate the time it took to set up and tear down the stage, three separate claws were needed, and each cost around $25 million. Plus, the daily operating costs were about $750,000, not including stage construction, which is about three times that of Zoo TV and Pop Mart.
That's right. It was, all told, the largest and most expensive concert stage ever constructed. But those bottom line figures did finally convince U2 after they'd grappled over it for so long and almost went bankrupt in the process to finally relent and have BlackBerry sponsor the 360 tour. And let's be honest, by 2009, it was no longer the moral conundrum it was in the 80s. But why BlackBerry? Well, Bono admitted he had a tantrum and told Apple CEO Steve Jobs to fuck off and took the 360 tour to their competition, BlackBerry. Kind of embarrassing.
Yeah, and Bono did publicly diss Apple when he spoke of going to BlackBerry's parent company called Research in Motion for support when he said, quote, "I'm very excited about this. Research in Motion is going to give us what Apple wouldn't, access to their labs and their people so we can do something really spectacular," unquote.
Now, to Jobs' credit, he never pulled support for Bono's Red campaign. And to both their credit, they did make peace before Jobs succumbed to cancer in 2011. So good on them for that. Mm-hmm. All right. As we covered, Bono had created characters for No Lawn in the Horizon And in the lead up to the tour, he initially tried to develop an onstage character like he did on Zoo TV with The Fly and McFisto. We first got a glimpse when they did Get On Your Boots at both the Grammys and the Brit Awards, when Bono took off his shades mid-song, revealing heavy eye makeup. Afterwards, he said it was meant to be more Elvis than emo, defending himself by stating, "I was calling him Elvis's dead brother Jesse," which maybe is in poor taste. "It's still in development," he cried. "I just started messing with it a few weeks ago."
Yeah. All that aside, I kind of liked Bono's goth look myself.
In any case, by the time the tour starts, there was no Jesse, or any character for that matter, unless you count him looking like Arnold Schwarzenegger in Terminator 2. in any respect, as has been the case since being woefully under-rehearsed for Pop Mart, the band does several promo appearances in the lead-up to the tour. Two of the more high-profile appearances were a broadcasted short set and interview at the intimate Somerville Theater in Boston, and as we mentioned, an unprecedented five-night stand on the David Letterman Show. During the promo tour and up through the first night of the tour in Barcelona, the band was playing the album version of If I Don't Go Crazy, and I have to say, I'd forgotten how much I liked the version on Letterman. And I know you didn't, but I'm going to make you listen to it, Melody.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Why don't we?
All right. So let's if you were super psyched to hear the album version on the tour, and again, I know Melody did not count herself among those, but don't forget, the band did release that version as a single just a month into the tour, but for whatever reason, from the second show of the tour onward, they did a version created by the music team, Fish Out of Water, as a mashup of remixes by Redonka and Dirty South. This had Larry walking around the outer stage playing a djembe, I believe it's pronounced, and the band vamping to that club remix. Now, I really came to love that live club remix. It really got you going, especially when the band got the crowd chanting, "If I Don't Go Crazy," telling them to sing for your sanity. Now, I wish they would have paired this with something from Pop or Zaropa for a little mid-set dance party, like Discotheque or Lemon. Alas, another instance, you two didn't listen to me. But in any case, let's listen to that live version.
She's a rainbow and she loves the peaceful life. Knows I'll go crazy if I don't go crazy tonight.
Now, this may surprise you, Bill, but I genuinely thought the remix version came off as lighthearted and fun. From the bobbing close-up of the band members' heads on the massive 360 screen to all the band members prowling the circular ramp that ringed the main stage. You know, it was a ton of energy coming from them into the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Now, according to Bono, at least on the first two legs of the tour in Europe and North America, If I Don't Go Crazy was intended to separate and disorient the audience between the first act of the show from Breathe to Vertigo, where Bono, quote, envisions himself as a young man struggling to find his feet in life and in search of some kind of personal epiphany, unquote, to the second act from Sunday Bloody Sunday to the encore, which focused more on Bono's political side. Now, I don't recall feeling disoriented per se, but I did think the song worked effectively as a transition point.
All right. Let's go back, though, to the tour opener in Barcelona at Camp Nou. This is an open-air stadium, so while the band rehearsed there the whole week leading up to the opener, fans outside could easily tape the rehearsals and put them online, which I was definitely monitoring at the time. And the most amazing thing I just wanted to mention was that the band actually rehearsed Drowning Man mm-hmm. for the show. And there's a pristine version you can listen to online. But according to Willie Williams, they dropped it because the rest of the set struggled due to Drowning Man's beautiful melancholy. So sadly, it wasn't to be, which is a major bummer. Kind of like a Holy Grail live mm-hmm. track, I would say. Anyway, the band walks on stage to a tape of Soon. And then at least for the first couple legs, they open with Breathe. Now, a lot of folks felt Magnificent should have been the opener, and I certainly think that would have worked better than Breathe, but that's just me. I also would have loved if they'd played Fez on the tour, like maybe back-to-back with The Unforgettable Fire, which was another nice surprise, and was the obvious, you know, sister piece. I mean, I don't know, maybe it was just too hard to replicate.
Perhaps. But, you know, let's get back to The Claw for a second. As we know, it looked like sort of a spaceship, and a space theme developed of sorts on the tour. It may be more of a thread than a clear thought, but the show did open with Bowie's Space Oddity, and Elton John's Rocket Man played after, as well as there were the pre-recorded messages from the International Space Station during the show with different astronauts quoting, you know, Beautiful Day, or Space Oddity, In a Little While, or Your Blue Room, which was cool.
And, you know, one of the memorable visuals of the tour came during the encore with the band doing Ultraviolet and Bono resplendent in a suit with embedded lasers that shone through the violet lighting scheme, hanging onto a illuminated steering wheel-shaped microphone dropped from above and swinging back and forth. I actually thought that was really cool.
Mm-hmm. It was a cool visual.
And then throughout the entire tour, the closer was Moment of Surrender with that great sing-along coda echoing into the night.
Right. Except, of course, for the last show, which was 40, but anyway.
Right, right.
Just pointing that out there.
Yes, because we have ball busters out there.
We do. We do. And I thought, if I don't say that, we're gonna get
Hey, man, don't
like
you
that.
Remember? You got that wrong, man.
We know it was 40 on the bus. We know.
Okay. Speaking of Moment of Surrender, in the midst of the first North American leg of the tour, the band does Saturday Night Live, performing Breathe and an incredible version of Moment of Surrender, with Bono doing an inspired spoken word improv. And if you don't mind, I just like to play that. The worst, the curse, was that dreams came true. God is a mirror which each man sees himself. Hell is a place where you don't need anyone's help. When I first met you, your face was like snow. Wherever I went, if you wanted to go. Your face, your grace, your can of mace. In a case as you put your face down. A17 on the ground, your faith in the clown. Don't
Bill, you and I were both at the penultimate show of the first North American leg of the tour, which, of course, was at the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, California, which is near Los Angeles. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners were also at this show, in a sense, when it was streamed live on YouTube. It was the first concert to be live streamed, I might add. And around approximately 10 million people across 188 countries reportedly watched the concert. And this concert was also later released as a DVD.
Yes. I mean, I have to say, you know, I was up close near the stage for this show. And I'm not saying it was a bad show, but I gotta be honest, something just felt missing. But not just that night. I also saw the show in Vegas shortly before then, again later on a leg in Anaheim, and it just never connected for me. It was a tremendous spectacle, but the set list seemed to be missing an emotional center. How about you?
Yeah, I liked the show at the Rose Bowl. Certainly better than the shows I saw on the final leg of the tour, also in Anaheim, in 2011. But yeah, you know, I agree with you. There was something that felt like it was missing from the tour. I mean, the band were playing great. It sounded great. It looked great. But yeah, the emotional X factor just wasn't there for me.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. So the band took a long break over winter and spring before starting rehearsals for the next U.S. leg. And then we're set to headline, for the first time ever, the Glastonbury Festival in June 2010. However, they had to postpone all of that after Bono sustained a devastating back injury on May 11th, just 24 hours after celebrating his 50th birthday. He was forced to undergo emergency spinal surgery in Munich, Germany, and then 8 weeks of rehab.
Yeah, if you've ever had any sort of spinal injury, I have. Just hearing about Bono's injury of a herniated disc, severe compression of his sciatic nerve, and partial paralysis of his leg makes my toes curl in horror. But anyway, U2 was replaced by Gorillaz at Glastonbury.
And The Edge ended up making a special appearance with Muse at Glastonbury, performing Where the Streets Have No Name together. Okay, now the tour then resumes in Turin, Italy on August 6, 2010, with Bono showing up, but with no signs of injury, bounding about the stage, shadow boxing, and describing himself as Bono 2.0.
Yeah, my favorite bit of that was when Bono thanked the German doctors from the stage and said, I've been rebuilt using the best engineering in the world, German engineering. I have made in Germany now stamped on my ass. I thought that was very funny.
Oh, very good. So this leg also saw the band play several unreleased songs they'd worked up while Bono was recuperating. This included the fan favorite Mercy, North Star, Boy Falls from the Sky from the Spider-Man Broadway musical, Return of the Stingray Guitar, which would evolve into the backing track for Lucifer Hands, you know, that later surfaces on the deluxe edition of Songs of Innocence. And they also did a song called Glastonbury, which they'd written specially for the festival. This song later mutates into parts of both Volcano and American Soul for the Songs of Innocence and Songs of Experience sessions, respectively. Mercy, they'd cut its length almost in half and added a little tagline to the end of the chorus. I prefer the rawness of the version that got cut at the last minute from the Atomic Bomb sessions, which we played back then. But this is still pretty great. And since the fan community loves it so much, we're going to play it. The speculation, though, I will just say, was that they were playing all these unreleased songs on this leg of the tour because they were slotted for Songs of Ascent, which was going to be the next record, so we thought. And we're still waiting for it, aren't we? Anyway, again, let's listen to Mercy. This is from Wide Awake in Europe EP, released for Record Day 2010. And it's the only official release version of Mercy. So let's give it a listen.
Now, by the third leg of the tour in Europe, from August to October of 2010, Breathe, No Line on the Horizon, and Unknown Caller had been dropped from the set, which I think gave the show more of a greatest hits with deep cuts thrown in feel than a promotion for their current album.
Definitely. And by the 2011 leg, they were doing a more Octoon Baby heavy set to mark the 20th anniversary of Octoon Baby, but clearly they'd lost belief in No Line on the Horizon. By the end of the tour, only Boots, If I Don't Go Crazy, and Moment of Surrender are still in the set list. Larry admitted, quote, it was a little bit of a defeat, end quote.
You know, and the band, they also pulled out some older songs as well as deep cuts. Those types of songs included Out of Control, Love Rescue Me, Bill and My Favorite Song.
Oh, yeah.
Stay, Electrical Storm, Zooropa, Scarlet, which was, we heard that on the shows that we saw. That was pretty cool.
That was very cool.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the aforementioned Your Blue Room, which included a pre-recorded vocal from Sinead O'Connor.
Okay, U2 also finally headlines day one of the Glastonbury Festival on June 24th, 2011, making up for the previous year's cancellation. It's a crowd-pleasing set with the first five songs from Octoon Baby and older songs like I Will Follow, Out of Control, and Bad. Only three songs are not singles, and two of them, Bad and Until the End of the World, are live favorites, along with Moment of Surrender. And they never even played the song they'd written for Glastonbury, even though they'd played it seven times on the tour. It rains for most of the set, and Bono made the curious claim that the reason they weren't at their best was because they wore the wrong shoes for the slippery stage.
And they're Irish. It doesn't make any sense.
I know.
Anyway. Now, while the band was playing at Glastonbury, there was a small protest by a group called Art Uncut, who planned to disrupt the performance and protest the band's 2006 decision to move their tax affairs from Ireland to the Netherlands. About 30 protesters huddled for about a half an hour to inflate a 30-foot-tall balloon with the words, "You pay tax too?" question mark. But once the balloon went up, security swarmed in, and after a short but violent scuffle, security tore the inflatable down. Now, most fans on the day probably didn't even see any of this, but there was quite a bit made of it in the press.
Mm, shocking that the British press would play that up.
Right, right.
All right. Now, during that last leg of the tour, on July 26, 2011, in Pittsburgh, Bad is added as a surprise set closer. Bono dedicates it to Andy Rowan, for whom Bad was written. Now, most folks know Andy Rowan is the brother of Bono's best friend, Gigi, and Peter Rowan, who's on the War album cover. And the Rowans lived at 5 Cedarwood Road, the Hewsons at 10 Cedarwood Road.
Mm-hmm.
And when Bono got to the end of the song while doing his snippet of Lou Reed's Walk on the Wild Side, Bono sings to Andy, calling him his Lipton Village name, Guck Pants, but changes it for Andy to I've Had It with the Walk on the Wild Side. Now, Melody, I've had this bootleg of this show for years, and I never knew why he sang that. Hmm. But I recently found out that's because Andy had just gotten out of rehab.
Oh,
For the first time. Yeah, for the first time getting clean in decades.
That's great.
And Andy was there that night in
that's
Pittsburgh.
That's cool.
Guck Pants came all the way from the north side, all the way to look Pittsburgh in the eye. Got his friends from Dublin town, this one back in town, the slamming star with a ticket in the eye. And all the people said, do, do, do. I've had it with a walk on the wild side. Had it with that walk in the wild side.
U2 closes out the 360 tour in Moncton, Canada on July 30th, 2011, by which time they had performed 110 dates around the world and were the highest grossing concert trek in history, with approximately $736 million in ticket sales. Now, I know a lot of people dug this tour, and God knows it did booming business, selling out literally every single show, which considering this was during a huge global recession was quite impressive. But while I admire the 360 tour as yet another huge leap forward in technology, design, and innovation, it is my least favorite U2 tour.
Yeah, and as I mentioned earlier, we're in agreement on this tour. It is my least favorite too. And, you know, now, truthfully, though, I'm not the biggest fan of stadium shows, no matter what the bells and whistles you bring. And there were massive bells and whistles here. Mm-hmm. I think it's hard for a performer to really connect with an audience emotionally at that scale. But that said, I did get more out of the Zoo TV and Pop Mart tours, maybe because both of those tours had a much more cohesive theme. You know, there was a purpose to all the spectacle. I don't know. With 360 though, there was, as you said, there was so much cool stuff going on, but it didn't seem to have the depth of the band's other tours emotionally or artistically. But, you know, as you said, a ton of people loved it. So, you know, different tastes, different strokes. There you go.
Yeah, no, very true. Okay. So we're going to push pause here. At least as things stand now, No Line on the Horizon is the last album produced by Brian Eno and Daniel Lanois. In addition, it would be the last album and tour with Paul McGuinness, the only manager U2 ever had. McGuinness would announce on November 13th, 2013, he was stepping down after 35 years managing U2. As part of a $30 million deal that would see Live Nation buy principal management, Madonna's manager, 41-year-old Guy Osiri, took over the day-to-day running of the U2 empire. But when Bono told McGuinness that Osiri would be stepping into his shoes, McGuinness couldn't resist taking a final jab by asking, quote, "Would Guy Osiri understand that you can't manage U2 on a BlackBerry? That managing the four of you is not managing Madonna, it's managing four Madonnas." I'm sorry.
That's it's really a total funny. Mic drop moment for McGuinness.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So it would be a very long 5.5 year wait for a new album, with the band involved in a lot of projects during this time, though. Notably, Bono and Edge were in the news quite a bit with the drama that was the Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark musical. Larry starred in two films. One of them came out in 2011, I'm aware, and then the other one came out in the interim between the two albums. And the band released the great 20th anniversary box set for Octung Baby, along with the release of the companion film From the Sky Down. But the fans kept waiting for a new record to drop.
That's right. The band was working on sporadically three different album projects: the still unreleased Songs of Ascent, a club record with Red One and David Guetta, and a rock album with Danger Mouse, One Republic frontman Ryan Tedder, and Adele producer Paul Epworth, among others. Now, the band would renew its partnership with Apple and devise a controversial plan for the release of their next album, Songs of Innocence, something that made a lot of people, the haters included, absolutely lose their damn minds.
Right. But we will get into all that next time on Into the Heart of U2 podcast.